In 1991, I finished my residency in surgery in Seattle, Washington. Hiking in Seattle meant pine needles, damp earth, a good rain show. You packed Gore-Tex. You expected mist or rain. And the forest smelled alive. And then I landed in Phoenix in July. Now, this wasn't a choice. I owed the federal government because they paid for my medical school. And when given a choice of places to go to fill that billet while I wanted to be in Anchorage, Phoenix was the only one that was open that actually involved the city. Well, hiking there meant bottled water and lots of it. And you didn't pack a shell, you packed survival. The day I went to Phoenix, it was 113 degrees at 6 o'clock in the evening. The hills had fires from small wildfires all over, and when you stepped out of the car, the air felt like someone opened the oven door and left it there. I didn't see beauty. I saw brown rocks, no pine trees, no water, and I remember thinking quite seriously, this must be the only place in the world where even the lizards carry venom. I was fairly certain I'd been sent there because I was going to hell and this was orientation. And it was really hotter than hell, and frankly, I suspect even Satan didn't vacation there. Only Canadians. And who could blame them? February in Toronto. But the desert waits you out. And eventually I fell in love with it. The rocks were copper at dusk. The saguaros now look like cathedral columns to me. And if you're patient, very patient, you might see one of the most beautiful and dangerous creatures in North America. The Gila monster. Beaded orange and black, skin like mosaic tile, heavy-bodied, deliberate, it doesn't rush, it doesn't need to. It has venom in its bite. Gila Bend is named after it. Gila River bears its name, and the desert itself named after this creature. And little did I know that this slow, venomous lizard would one day give me the medication I inject today. Zepbound. Today, on Fork U, we will be making sense of the madness of GLP-1 and the lizards who gave them to us. I am your chief medical explanationist, Dr. Terry Simpson, and this is Fork U, Fork University, where we make sense of the madness, bust a few myths, and teach you a little bit about food and medicine. A year before I left Seattle in 1990, an endocrinologist named John Ng isolated a peptide from the saliva, or the venom, of the Gila monster. Now, he wasn't hunting reptiles. He was studying glucose regulation, because think of this. The Gila monster doesn't eat that often, so how do they regulate their glucose? We regulate it second by second. They didn't. And from the venom, he isolated a molecule called extendin-4. 2 years later, while I was now at Phoenix, at the Bronx VA Medical Center, he purified it and published the results, and here was the key. It resembled human GLP-1, or glucagon-like peptide 1, but it lasted longer. Native GLP-1, the kind that you and I build, survives in circulation about 2 minutes. 2 minutes. And that's before your own body has an enzyme, which is called DPP-4, destroys it. Now, extendin-4 resisted that breakdown. It had staying power. And the discovery eventually became the medication known as Byetta, which was first released for the United States in 2005. It was the first GLP-1 receptor agonist. It was a drug for diabetes, not a weight loss drug, not a cultural phenomenon, just careful endocrinology. All of this happened while I was in Phoenix. One of the things that they noticed about this drug was that the patients who were on it lost weight. And so when I would be dealing with my friends who were in internal medicine and they would have a patient who had both diabetes and excess weight, they would start putting them on Byetta on the hopes that they would lose 2 to 4 kilograms. Now, everything intersected for me in Phoenix. I had begun my career at the Phoenix Indian Medical Center, and that's where I cut my teeth doing weight loss surgery. Type 2 diabetes among Pima Indians in Arizona is among the highest prevalence recorded anywhere in the world. Obesity rates were also high. Metabolic disease was everywhere. But in Phoenix, and especially at the medical center, it wasn't just clinical, it was also scientific. There's a metabolic ward there, which is basically a hospital ward dedicated to doing research about diet and fat mass. And it's from the National Institutes of Health. It was in Phoenix that the thrifty gene hypothesis was articulated in that ecosystem, which means something like this. Efficiency in scarcity becomes liability in abundance. Meaning, if you're in an area where you can't eat much, when you can eat much, you tend to store more. Now, there's more than one thrifty gene, as we found out. There's multiple ones, but at that time, we only thought about one. Here's a funny thing. The person who actually invented the thrifty gene hypothesis offered me a job at the NIH. And sometimes I think, what a fascinating ride that would have been. But we can't go back, except in history. So anyway, as I became known in the weight loss surgery world, these drugs were being studied, modified, lengthened, refined. And I remember this friend of mine. She was actually involved in some of the early trials, and I remember this conversation vividly. She said, "We have drugs that are going to replace surgery someday." I kind of scoffed at her. Replace surgery? Nothing replaces surgery. But guess what? She was right. Because during the 1990s, the late 1990s, were the Fen-Phen revolution, and you may remember hearing about that. Two drugs put together led to weight loss, a lack of interest in weight, until we discovered that there were issues with the tricuspid valve of the heart, and some patients actually had to have heart surgery because of this combination of drugs, which is no longer available thanks to FDA monitoring. So Byetta was the first drug that showed this promise. And then they began to refine the drug, not only for the GLP-1 effects on diabetes, but also for weight loss. The next medications were lagrutide, semaglutide, and tirzepatide, or Zepbound. Scientists continued to engineer longer half-lives by attaching fatty acid side chains so the molecules bind to the albumin in your body and they circulate longer. Now, you make GLP-1. Your body makes it, but it lasts about 2 minutes, whereas Ozempic or semaglutide lasts about a week. Tirzepatide lasts about 5 days. They're stable levels, steady receptor activation, not spikes and crashes, and in obesity trials, Ozempic produced weight loss approaching 15% of body weight, and the pills about the same. Tirzepatide or Zepbound exceeded 20% in the higher doses. And those approaches kind of began to match surgical outcomes. Even more importantly, cardiovascular outcome trials showed that reduction in major adverse cardiac events. So this wasn't just beach season medicine. This is heart attack and stroke medicine. Now let's talk about what patients describe and have described to me from every one of them that I've operated on. Food noise, not hunger, noise, a constant loop saying, what's next? What's in the fridge? Maybe I'll have a little more. Now, GLP-1 receptors are expressed in your brain in a place called the hypothalamus and the brainstem. And these drugs act by vagal signaling, meaning the vagus nerve, which goes down to your stomach and bowels, in areas where the blood-brain barrier is more permissive. They modulate appetite circuits. They dampen reward signaling. They amplify satiety. And for many people, the noise quiets, not disappears, quiets. And that difference matters. When I had my first injection of Zepbound back in October of 2024, about 12 hours later, I noticed it was quiet in my brain. I didn't realize I had food noise. I don't think I understood what food noise was. I thought it was just this relentless desire that my patients had, but it was something deeper. And all of a sudden, I could turn away from the plate and walk away and not think about it again. I could plan my vacations around historical objects instead of the next Michelin star restaurant. I wasn't interested in what we were going to have for dinner that night. I was interested in what we were going to do. But you know who isn't thrilled with GLP-1 therapy? Diet culture. The low-carb absolutist. The just-eat-fewer-calories coaches. The ones selling books, meal plans. Because obesity is purely willpower in their minds. And their answer is always try harder. Or that obesity is a moral failure, then shame for its treatment. But if obesity is neurohormonal dysregulation, the story changes, and so does their business model. So no one worked harder at weight loss than my patients. No one. And I don't lack willpower either. I know food. I practice culinary medicine. I live and eat the Mediterranean diet, and you should too. But biology does not negotiate with virtue. When people told my surgery patients that surgery was the easy way out, they revealed how little they understood, because surgery is not easy, and injecting myself once a week is not easy. I know it's hard to believe, but this surgeon has a phobia of needles, and yet I do it. Calling a doctor and asking for help, that takes courage. There are parallel universes in this story. In one, my career remained purely surgical, revision surgery when weight returns, and in this one, when revision loomed, I began to reach for GLP-1 therapies instead. Less incision, more physiology. In the one universe, I actually considered surgery for myself. In this universe, I made a phone call to a physician. And now, I weigh what I weighed when Nixon was president. I am both a surgeon and a patient and your reporter. Now let me give you the caution. GLP-1 drugs have risks and benefits. They can cause nausea, they can slow gastric emptying, you can become dehydrated. Some people talk about gallbladder risk, but remember, obesity itself carries a much higher gallbladder risk than GLP-1s do. These drugs need monitoring, and if you're going to use one, you deserve a physician who is yours. Someone trained in obesity medicine, not a pop-up website, not a quick script mill. This is serious metabolic therapy, and it deserves serious medical supervision. And no, I am not your doctor, nor will I be. I once believed that I had been sent to Phoenix as punishment. It was hotter than hell. Even Satan, I suspect, vacations elsewhere, and only Canadians brave July. But what I thought was exile was preparation. In the same desert where I learned to operate on metabolic disease, in that same ecosystem where the thrifty gene hypothesis was debated, a slow, beautiful, venomous lizard carried the molecular key to a revolution. I thought I'd been sent to hell. It turns out, I had been sent to the future. Please check the blog associated with this at yourdoctorsorders.com and forkyou.com. And please check out my Substack at drsimpson.com. This was written and researched by me, Dr. Terry Simpson, and while I am a board-certified physician, I am not your physician. If you're considering GLP-1 therapy or changing your diet, you deserve a board-certified physician trained in obesity medicine and a registered dietitian, not a quick online script mill. Please consult your own physician before making medical decisions. All things audio are done by our friends at Simpler Media and the pod god himself, Mr. Eve Otero. Producer Girl Productions make me sound more interesting than I am. Have a good week, everybody. Hey, Evo. If there are parallel universes, I'd like to think that in one of them, I stayed in Seattle and never met the lizard. But in this universe, evolution outperformed diet culture. It turns out the future was crawling across a desert rock the whole time. One of the best things about Phoenix was meeting you.
Hey, Allie, Terry finally said something nice about me, so cancel that rate increase I had planned. Thanks.